I need to switch. The recording is on, by the way. Is there any way I can view it as it's up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They'll take it out. Do you need water or anything?
I think I'm okay. Okay, let's get started. I'm Gavin Lineman, an analyst for State Farm Insurance, and with me today is Amy Ukanellis, assistant actuary for Allstate, and we'll be covering the development of an overall indication and then the calculation of rate making relativities. So some of the basics to rate making analysis. And the first thing we'll cover is the basic rate making equation. And there are several pieces to that, including the organization of data, including premium adjustments, adjustments to losses, expense considerations, and then other considerations that need to go into the. Look closer. Okay. And there are three common ways to organize data, and those include calendar year, policy year, and accident year. Calendar year data is to take the premiums and losses that only occurred during a calendar year. And that would include loss payments that were made during the year on new claims and also changes in reserves on past claims that happened during the year. And there are advantages and disadvantages to each of these methods. For the calendar year analysis, the advantage is you're going to match financial statements. Financial statements are done on a calendar year basis. The data will be frozen once you're through the calendar year. If you go back and look at calendar year next year from 2004, 2005, it's going to stay static. It won't change. The disadvantage is the premiums and losses aren't going to match. And by that I mean you're collecting premiums on stuff in, say, 2006. You could have loss adjustments on policies that were written in 2003, 2004, 2005 that are also being included in this data. So the loss experience could reflect things that happened in years prior where the premiums weren't really written. And because of that, you can get a lot of distortion, particularly if your company is growing, whereas you've had less exposures in past years and future development on this year may be larger than you've historically seen. Policy year data is another way that you can organize data. And in this case, you get an exact match of premiums to losses. You are looking at transactions on all premium and loss for policies with an effective date during the year. And again, the matching of premiums and losses is a big advantage to this method. The problem you get is something that's written on, say, 12/31 won't actually be concluded. The policy won't finish up until the very end of the next year. So there's a large lag on information. You won't have final information of this year's data until the very end of next year, which can be problematic. And sometimes it's difficult to get the losses coded to policy year, so having the data organized in that manner can sometimes be a difficulty. Accident year is a third method of organizing data. In this case, it's kind of a cross between the calendar year and policy year data. What you've got in this is premium transactions during the 12 months and loss transactions for accidents that occurred during the year. So you get less effect on the reserve changes that you had with the calendar year. There is a slight time lag. Sometimes a policy that was written in 2006 could have a 2007 loss, and there'll be a one-year offset. But in general, there's a better match of premiums and losses than you would see with calendar year data. And with both accident year and policy year data, you won't be able to have exact ultimate losses until all the losses have settled, reserve changes are made. You can only make an estimate of what ultimate losses are going to be. The basic rate-making equation is that future premiums need to equal your future losses, your future expenses, and then also with that, the insurance company is going to need to collect a profit and also a contingency provision. And what a contingency provision is, an allowance for adverse deviation from what's expected when the rate making is settled. An example would be the onset of asbestos losses several decades ago that weren't really contemplated in rating, but then had an adverse deviation in the loss experience. And there are two basic rate making methods. The first is a loss ratio method, in which you're developing an indicated rate change. And in this, you're comparing an experience loss ratio to a target loss ratio, which we'll cover in later slides, but is the loss ratio after taking out expenses and the profit provision. There's also a pure premium method in which you're actually calculating an indicated rate per unit of exposure. And that formula is to look at your pure premium, which is the losses divided by your exposure units plus fixed expenses, divided by 1 minus the variable expense ratio minus the profit ratio. And these two methods should produce identical results if you're using the same set of data and assumptions. And we're going to go through an example of the loss ratio methodology. And in this, again, you've got an experience loss ratio divided by your target loss ratio to come up with an indicated change. So we're going to go through how we develop that experience loss and fixed expense ratios. And in this example, we've got an increase of 17.9%. So we're going to go through each step that was taken to calculate that indicated change. And the first thing we'll do with loss ratio methodology is make adjustments to both premiums and losses. For premiums, we'll have to adjust to the current rate level and also look at trends on premiums. For loss adjustments, we'll look at development of losses to an ultimate basis, loss trends that may be occurring, and also adjustments for catastrophes.
Okay, so we're going to keep coming back to this rate indication worksheet that we're showing right here. This, we're going to walk step by step through to get back to that 17.9% indication that you saw on the slide two slides ago. So if you skip down to the bottom there and you see the indicated rate level change, that is, again, that experience loss ratio and fixed expense ratio from row A divided by the expected loss and fixed expense ratio in row B. To calculate the first part, which is where we're going to start, the experience loss and fixed expense ratio, we're going to need to take trended ultimate loss and LAE. We're going to add expected CAT loss and LAE for the projection period, add fixed expenses, and then divide by the trended premium at current rate level. And we'll walk through each of those steps separately. We're going to make a few assumptions as we go through this example. We're going to assume that we're writing annual policies. We're revising our rates as of January 1st, 2008. Of the two methodologies that Gavin went over, we're going to use the loss ratio methodology. We're also going to assume that we have enough data in 1 year to just do the indication based on 1 year. So we're going to use accident year 2006. We're going to have 2006 earned premium of $3.69 million and reported incurred losses as of 12/31/06 of $1.9 million. The first adjustments we're going to look at are our adjustments to premium, and the very first adjustment to premium is going to be our current rate level adjustment. the period we're looking at, the 2006 earned premium, if we've taken a rate change during that time, it's not fully reflected within that earned premium. So we need to make sure that the loss ratio method is using current rates. So we're really analyzing the appropriateness of the current rates for use in the future. And we are making this adjustment for rate changes not already included in the premium. There's two common techniques for a current rate level adjustment. One is the extension of exposures method. In this method, and we'll show a little bit of example, we re-rate each exposure or policy. It's definitely the most accurate method, but it requires a lot of time, detail, and mechanization to be able to re-rate your whole policy book. The second method is the parallelogram method, which is much easier because we don't need specific policy information, but we do have to assume that we write policies evenly throughout the year. So here's our example of the extension of exposures method, and this is a pretty basic example. This could only be used if you really only had two rating variables. You know, if there were only three territories and two classes, and that's the only way you segmented your book. We divide the exposures by those classes and territories. We look at the current rates we have, and we just take the premium times the current rate, the exposure times the current rate to get our premium at current rate level. And again, as you have more variables and more numbers of possibilities for each variable, this becomes quite a detailed process. So in this way, we're showing a statewide total of about $4 million, and that would be our 2006 premium that we're assuming we're now writing at a current rate level. The second method is the parallelogram method. Definitely an easier method to explain with pencil and paper, so we'll give it a try here. But what we're doing here is we're looking at each of these rectangles, and each of these is a calendar year. So since we're focusing in on our example at 2006 earned premium, we're going to focus in on that rectangle that's 106 to 107. For our example, we're assuming that we didn't make any rate changes from 1105 to 63006. So we're saying we're at this rate index of 1.0. It's kind of our base. Then we're assuming that at 7106, we're making a rate change, and it's a 12% increase. Now, we set annual policies, so at 7106, if we assume that we're writing policies evenly, we're going to write that first policy at 7106 or renew that first policy at 7106 at the 12% rate change, but it's not going to be until 7107 that everybody is at that new rate level. So we draw this diagonal line that you see there, and that splits out 2006 calendar year into Section A and Section B. Section A is at that rate index of 1, and then Section B is at that rate index that's 12% higher because of the rate change we took. So we measure the area of each of those sections, and the area of A is 87.5% of total calendar year 2006, and B is 12.5. So we simply measure or multiply that 87.5 times the rate index of 1, add together the 12.5 times the rate index that's 12% higher, and we get a total that is 1.015, which means that for 2006, we were 1.5% higher than our base as far as our rates went. So we know that our current rates are 12% higher than our base, so we take the 1.12 over the 1.015, and that gives us a factor of 1.103. So we need to multiply 2006 earned premium by 1.103 to get to what 2006 would have looked like if we wrote everyone under today's rates. So that gives us an earned premium of $4.07 million. Okay. So on that rate indication worksheet now, we've filled in that second row. We already assumed 2006 earned premium of $4.69 million, and now we have our current rate level factor, which is 1.103. The next adjustment we're going to make to premium, or the only other adjustment we're going to make to premium, is a premium trend adjustment. We need to project the premium level, which will exist during the period being priced, and this is for things outside of rates. The premium trend really accounts for shifts of business that also impact losses. So the examples that we showed on here are average car, model year, or price group. If we're writing newer cars, you know, that's gonna be higher premium for us. Average home value, if the home values are going up, that you're gonna see a shift in your premium towards higher premium values. Territorial distribution shift to lower rated or higher rated territories makes a difference. And we're really going to look for any shift on any item that would impact future premium or both premium and losses in the future, except for policy count. So in this example, we're going to just give you an average annual trend of 2%, but now we have to determine what the trend period's going to be. What we want, just as a reminder, we're doing annual policies and rates to be revised as of January 1st, 08. And for this example, we're assuming really that the rates will be in effect for 1 year so that we would take another rate change at 1/1/09. So we need to determine the trend period, and we're going to trend from the average earned date in the experience period to the average earned date in the exposure period. So the average earned date in the experience period is pretty easy because our experience period is just 2006, so the average date is 7/1/06. Now, in our exposure period, we have to determine the average earned date. We know we write our first policy under those new rates at 1/1/08. So that policy comes to us at 1/1/08, and it's good until 12/31/08. The last policy we could write under those rates would be 12/31/08, and the policy would be with us through 12/31/09. So you kind of have to determine that, okay, the average policy I write is midway through that 2008 year, so I'm writing them 7/1/08. And they're going to be a year policy, so 7/1/08 through 6/30/09. And the average time we're earning their premium is right at 1/1/09. So our trend period here is the date from, or the time from 7/1/06 to 1/1/09, or 2.5 years. So we take that 1.02 raised to the 2.5, and we get a trend of 1.051. So we fill that next into our rate indication worksheet. It's our next, or row three, the premium trend factor is 1.051. So now we've just calculated that denominator for row A, and our trended premium at current rate level is going to be 4.278 million.
Okay. That covers the premium section of the rate indication, but we still have to address losses. So the next section will be to look at loss development, how to account for loss adjustment expenses, and there are two general categories of loss adjustment expense. Allocated loss adjustment expense is claim specific. It might be court claims handling that's related to a specific claim. And then you also have unallocated loss adjustment expense, which isn't necessarily claim specific, but is still related to claims activity. And ALAE typically in practice is lumped with loss, so we really don't differentiate between those. We pull loss and allocated loss adjustment expense separately or together and just use that for trending purposes. And then unallocated loss adjustment expense is then loaded as a ratio of loss to ALAE, and we'll cover that in a later slide. We'll also look at loss trends and then catastrophe adjustments that need to be made to the loss experience. The first piece is loss adjustments or loss development, and in that we're trying to develop the historical losses to an expected ultimate value. And the reason we need to get to the difference between the historical losses and the ultimate is you can have revisions to the claim values as you're settling claims. We might under reserve to start with, and we're initially setting up an incurred amount, and then over time it'll grow, and there's a systematic pattern to it. And also the development of like incurred but not reported losses, things that we don't know about yet at the end of the policy period may spring up related to an accident year. And the key things you need to look consider when going through loss development is, are you going to use incurred amounts, which would be the estimates we make for the total losses when we write the claim, or are you going to use paid amounts in order to do the loss development? Just use paid values over time. And either way can work. It's just a matter of preference and whatever you decide to do. How long do you want the development period to be? And that could depend on what type of business you're writing. A liability line could take several years to develop. A line like homeowners insurance might have a very short development period. In this example, to explain this table, we've got our accident years as rows and reported dates across the columns. So the way to interpret this is, for instance, for accident year 2006, at the end of the year, we had a reported incurred loss amount of $1.9 million. And even with incurred losses, that includes an estimate of what the ultimate losses will be, a lot of times there's still some sort of a trend to our experience where the development still has a pattern to it where we may under reserve at the beginning and then it develops forward. So we still need to look at adjustments even for incurred losses. And the way we calculate development factors is to calculate the difference between a given accident year at one period of development compared to the development period before that. Again, in this example, we'll take accident year 2004. At the end of the first 12 months, the incurred losses were $1.5 million. At the end of 24 months, the amount of the incurred losses was $1.8 million. So the age-to-age development factor from 12 to 24 months for accident year 2004 can then be calculated as 20% by taking 1.8 divided by 1.5. Restating this to just show the development periods rather than the losses, you can see there is a lot more development in the first 12 months in this example, but there is still some development from 24 to 36, and then beyond 36 we don't see much development. So we can take kind of either an average or a trended value, depending on what you're seeing in the data. In this case we'll take an average, and use that as our selected loss development factors. So 2006, which was only at 12 months of development in this experience period, would need to be developed for not only the 12 to 24 month period, but also 24 to 36 months. And the cumulative factor below the 1.279 reflects both the 12 to 24 month development period and the 24 to 36 month development period. And again, showing that if we were using multiple accident years, it would depend on, after 36 months, we weren't seeing any development. So 2003 and 2004 would not need any additional development. 2005 was at 24 months of development. There was still that 2.5% adjustment needed for it to get to estimated ultimate loss. And then 2006, we had a factor of 27.9 to get up to the estimated ultimate loss. Again, for this analysis, we're using just 2006 losses. So the ultimate losses would be 2.43, which would be the 2006 accident year losses with the development factor of 27.9 or 1.279 applied to it. That was for moving on to unallocated loss adjustment expense. We can look at an average ratio of ULAE expense to incurred loss and ALAE. And in this example, the ratio is around 10%, so that's what we have selected as our estimated ULAE percentage. Back to the rate indication worksheet. The ULAE factor would be 1.1. That covers the loss development ULAE. We also need to look at loss trends, similar to how we looked at premium trends. And there are a ton of different data issues that could be present depending on what data you're looking at. Depending on how much experience you actually have and how many policies you may have in your books, if you don't have a huge amount of exposure, you may have to look at external data as a comparison. You can look at either combine pure premiums or also take it into individual components and look at frequency trends and severity trends separately, whether the data is paid, incurred, or reported, calendar accident year. So just what data you're looking at will have different implications. Length of the historical period, again, kind of with the internal versus external data, how much credibility do you really have in your data if you don't have a lot of experience to look at? Do you need to make credibility assumptions to kind of smooth the data, to remove random fluctuations? And then to trend historical data, what method are you going to use? It could be a least squares regression, use a time series or econometric model. Those are all decisions the actuary would have to make as they're reviewing the data. In this sample, we're going to look at pure premium over an 8-year period, and the pure premium again is calculated by taking paid losses divided by earned exposures, And then using a least squared trend over that period calculates out to be a 6.6% trend. And the most recent development period from 2005 to 2006, the increase was 4.7%. So in this sample, we're going to choose a 5% trend to reflect the more recent 2005 to 2006 development. And if we didn't feel comfortable with our own data, other possible trend sources would be consumer price indexes for calculating up losses of different costs. Depending on what type of analysis you're doing, if it's more medical cost related, you might look at the medical care index, body work index for auto losses, or home maintenance for homeowners type exposures. Again, the annual loss trend we selected was 5%, but you do have a trend period of 2.5 years from the slide that Amy went through earlier. So the actual trend factor would be 1 plus the 5% to a factor of 2.5, which ends up being a 1.13 trend factor, bringing trended ultimate losses in LAE to $3.02 million.
The next thing we're going to talk about is catastrophes. Your catastrophes should be removed from your loss data that you were using in the earlier calculations. You know, we want to do that because if we're only looking at 1 year of data for this indication, you can imagine a state maybe like Florida would have a huge, large indication 1 year, and then we'd look at the next year and it might have a large negative. So to gain some stability, we take catastrophes out of the losses and use an average provision instead. And your average provision generally will be using some sort of methodology that just looks over many more years, 25 or more, whatever your company might use. So we use this average provision instead. With a lot of methodologies, we're just going to go ahead and give you the number for the purpose of our example. We're going to say that we have expected annual catastrophe loss and ALAE for the projection period of 394. So we just put that over our projected premium to come up with a 9.21% cat load. And then that goes into our rate indication worksheet. So now we have both the 9 and 10 row to fill in for the experience loss and fixed expense ratio. So the only thing we have left for that numerator of the loss ratio methodology is fixed expenses. This just kind of shows all of the expenses, the direct expenses, other than loss adjustment, because as Gavin said, we already factored in both the allocated and the unallocated loss adjustment expenses. So now we're looking at all of our other variable and fixed expenses. From this list, everything is going to be shown as a ratio to written premium. Commissions and premium taxes are our variable expenses. They vary directly with premium. You know, we're going to pay more commissions if we're writing more. We're going to have to pay more taxes if we're writing more. Our other acquisition and general expenses are our fixed expenses. And we call them fixed expenses. They're not really fixed because they vary with inflation, but they're not dependent on premium. Our other acquisition costs might be related to what doesn't vary by premium, but what we have to spend to get business into the door. So maybe marketing or advertising. Our administrative, or they're also called general expenses, those do not vary by premium either. They're going to be like salaries of the employees, rent for the building. So they vary by inflation, but they definitely don't vary with premium. So in this example, we showed each of these different expenses as a ratio to written premium and looked at the last 3 years and made a selection based off of that. Our commissions and our taxes are basically just the average of the 3 years, but also they were very constant since they vary by premium. And then our other AC and administration expenses are just based on the most recent year. So we separate these into variable and fixed columns in this slide just to have them summed up so that we can use them in our example. We've also added profit and contingency and other costs to this slide. So commissions show up in the variable column like we talked about. Other acquisition and general or administrative expense both show up in fixed. Taxes, licenses, and fees show up in the variable column. Our profit and contingency is dependent on the premium we write. That shows up in the variable column. And then other costs such as policyholder dividends, involuntary market costs, guarantee fund assessments, etc., those show up in the variable column as well. And they're not always allowable by all the states, but so that's kind of our little disclaimer down there at the bottom, but they are shown in the variable column. So if you add it all up, we have total expenses and profit of 35.6%. 23.4 of that is variable, and 12.2 of that is fixed. We use those numbers to target what's going to be in the denominator of our loss ratio methodology equation 2, which is the target loss, loss adjustment expense, and fixed expense ratio. That's simply 1 minus the variable expense. It really means for every dollar we collect, how much are we targeting to pay out in losses, loss adjustment expenses, or fixed expenses. So that would be, in this example, it would be 76.6%, and that's our target loss ratio. All right, so we filled in 11. It was a 12.2%. Multiply that against our 2006 earned premium for 450. We also filled in our expected loss and fixed expense ratio of 76.6. So we have everything we needed to calculate row A. We have trended ultimate losses and LAE of 3.02 million, expected CAT loss and LAE of 394, fixed expenses of 450. That all goes over our trended premium, and it gives us an experience loss ratio of 90.3%. So our indicated rate level change is that 90.3% over the 76.6. Obviously, our experience loss ratio is much worse than our expected loss ratio, so that's generating a rate need of 17.9%. Excuse me. We're going to transition into the rate-making relativities now. We're going to talk about this in a few sections, why there are rate relativities, consideration in determining rating distinctions, basic methods and examples, and then some advanced methods. So why are there rate relativities? Why not just charge everyone the same amount? Well, individual insureds differ in risk potential, and they differ in the amount of insurance coverage purchased. So if they're a higher risk, we want to be able to charge them more. If they purchase more insurance, it should make sense that that they have to pay more than someone who doesn't. So with rate relativities, each group pays its own share of losses. We achieve equity among insureds, which is what's termed fair discrimination. You know, we're discriminating to the point that group is paying what they should pay because of their loss potential. And then we avoid anti-selection. So what is anti-selection? Anti-selection can result when a group can be separated into two groups or more, but it hasn't been separated. So you should consider a group with an average cost of $150, and if we just decided we were going to charge everyone $150, that was going to be easiest. But if subgroup A really costs us $100 and subgroup B really costs us $200, a competitor is likely to charge $100 to group A. We'll lose all of group A. We'll only be left with group B, which is costing us $200, but we're insuring them for $150. So that's anti-selection. Oh, we have been selected against. Considerations in setting rating distinctions. There are four groups of considerations in setting rating distinctions, and they don't often always work together. Sometimes they're working against each other. First, one of the things we're going to talk about when deciding if we should introduce a new rating variable are operational considerations. Does this rating variable or distinction have an objective definition? Is it clear who is in the group and who's not in the group? Administrative expenses. How hard is it to for us to track who is in that group? Verifiability. You know, can we verify that that person really should qualify to be in the group or not be in the group? You know, an example might be that in auto insurance, it might make sense to charge someone more if they're constantly talking on their cell phone while driving. But are we really ever going to know? We could ask the insured, but we really have no way to verify that they do or they don't. We have legal considerations. Obviously, the rating variable or distinction has to be constitutional, and it has to meet statutory or regulatory requirements. There's social considerations, privacy. You know, the insured probably doesn't want us looking into every aspect of their life. Causality. They'd like to know that the rating variable, like they'd like to see the connection between the rating variable and what we're charging them. I think that that's caused some interesting conversations around credit score, you know, seeing the causality of using credit score as a rating variable. Controllability, they like to see that they have some sort of control over what they're being charged. So in, for instance, you know, your accident history, if it's used for auto, that makes sense. Okay, I had accidents, I caused them, it makes more sense that maybe I should be paying more. And affordability, certainly that's a social consideration, that insurance should be affordable. Then there's actuarial considerations. Accuracy, the variables we use should measure cost differences. Homogeneity, all members of a class should have the same expected cost. Reliability, they should be stable. The rating variable should have stable mean value over time. It doesn't make sense if we're constantly adjusting rates because of whatever rating variable we've introduced isn't stable. And then credibility, groups should be large enough to permit measuring costs. So for instance, like two in there that are competing against each other are homogeneity and credibility. Credibility, you need to be large enough to make sure that you're permitting measuring costs, but you want to have homogeneity so that all members of the class are so specific that they have the same expected costs, and those work against each other sometimes.
Okay, assuming we've got a rating variable that we're comfortable with, there are again two basic methods for determining rate relativities, and you'll notice these are the same as when we're looking at overall change. One is to look at a loss ratio relativity method, and that again it determines an indicated change in your relativities rather than just raw relativities, and then pure premium, which actually just produces an indicated relativity. And again, as long as your data is roughly the same, your assumptions are similar, these methods should produce identical results. An example of a loss ratio relativity method, we've gotten two classes, class one and class two, with premiums at current rate level and losses. Looking at this, the class one has a loss ratio of 0.65 and class two has a loss ratio of 0.52. For a relativity, if you divide both by 0.65, we're assuming class 1 is the base, the relativity would be 1 for class 1 and 0.8 for class 2. Now again, this is the loss ratio method calculates a change in relativity. So knowing that the current relativity is 1 for class 1 and 2 for class 2, you would have to take the loss ratio relativity, multiply it by the current relativity to get your indicated relativity of 1.6 for class 2. For pure premium, it's simply a calculation of your losses divided by your exposures for both classes, and then divide by the base class, which in this case is class 1. So for this example, your indicated pure premium relativity is 1.55 for class 2. Now, one important consideration for calculating relativities for a rating variable is credibility. How comfortable do we really feel with the data that we're using, and do we need to make an adjustment to account for random variation and just to smooth it out a little bit? And in credibility formulas, typically Z, I don't know why it was chosen, is used as the rating variable for credibility. And the calculation of the credibility-weighted loss ratio is to take the credibility times the loss ratio of the class that we're actually looking at, plus 1 minus Z times a credibility complement. In this case, we're going to use the overall state loss ratio as our complement. And there are three methods you can use to estimate credibility. Actually, probably more than that, but three common uses. Methods. One is to just make a judgmental selection about how comfortable we feel with the data. Another is Bayesian credibility. In this, you take a K value, which is the expected variance within classes, divided by the variance between classes. And to explain that, the variance between classes is how much variance are you expecting between your between the means of the groups of the overall classes to the overall mean for the entire state. And then the expected variance within classes is like random noise just within the class and the experience. So the more we can actually, more of the variance we can actually describe using our classifications, the more credibility we're going to give to those classes. And their calculation is Z equals E, which is the exposures, divided by E plus K. In the classical credibility method, you take a full credibility standard K, which isn't the same K as in Bayesian, and an observed number of claims, and calculate Z as N divided by K squared, or not squared, the square root of N over K. And if N is actually greater than your full credibility standard, you give it full credibility. Again, going back to our example, the loss ratios are 65 and 52% for classes 1 and 2. In this case, we're going to assign a credibility of 0.5 for class 1 and 0.9 for class 2. So the credibility weighted loss ratio for the calculation of class 1 would be 0.65 times 0.5 for the credibility. And then you take your remainder of credibility, which would again be 0.5, and take that as multiplied by your loss ratio for the entire state, which is given below as 0.56, to calculate a credibility weighted loss ratio of 0.61. Taking the same method for class 2 develops a credibility weighted loss ratio of 0.52 for a loss ratio relativity of 1 and 0.85. Again, comparing that to a current relativity of 1 and 2 for classes 1 and 2 respectively, comes up with a relativity of 1.7 for class 2. However, in calculating a relativity, you may not get an overall premium that is equivalent to whatever your current premium level is, so you need to make an off-balance adjustment to balance out the premium. For instance, in this case, the premium was at almost $4 million at the current relativities of 1 and 2. Using the methodology to calculate proposed relativities, we got relativities of 1 and 1.7. To get a proposed premium of $3.574 million, which is below what our current premium level is at 3.9, almost 4. So we need an off-balance of 11.9% applied equally across the classes to get to the same overall premium level that we started with. Expense flattening is another consideration that needs to be made when looking at class relativities. The prior slides were showing things comparing losses to losses, but we really didn't account for expenses in those relativities. For example, if we have a $62 loss cost with $25 of variable expense and $13 of fixed expense for an overall premium of $100, if we're calculating our class relativity based on just losses and get a class relativity of 1.7, your total premium would go up to $170. However, it's really only losses that 1.7 would apply to. So what you should be charging is the $62 of loss times 1.7 plus your fixed expenses divided by 1 minus the variable expense using the pure premium formula to get an overall rate of $158. So if you just simply took that class relativity and applied it to the starting premium, you'd be overcharging that risk. So the expense flattening formula would take 1 minus the fixed expense ratio minus the variable expense ratio times the class relativity plus fixed expenses divided by 1 minus variable expenses to get to the 1.5 factor that you really should be charging. Moving on to deductible credits. For deductibles, the insurance policy pays for losses left to be paid over a fixed deductible, so losses in excess of whatever deductible the policy has. And a deductible credit is going to be a function of those remaining losses. Again, because the expenses of selling the policy and non-claims expenses may not change based on the deductible, we also need to consider the expenses that are fixed when determining deductible credits. The deductible formula uses loss elimination ratios, or LERs for short, And the LER just gives a percentage of the losses that are going to be removed by changing deductibles. And the LER is going to be composed of two different things. For losses that are actually below the deductible, for instance, we have a $250 deductible, we have a loss of $100, all of those losses below that deductible threshold are going to be eliminated. And for losses that are above the deductible, say we have a $500 loss, 250 of those, of that total $500 of loss, is going to be removed by using the deductible. So we need to account for those things, the losses below that are going to be completely eliminated, and the portion of losses above the deductible that would also be eliminated by using the deductible. And the formula is to take the total losses below the deductible, below or equal to the deductible level, plus your deductible multiplied by the number of claims above the deductible, and divide that by your total losses prior to using the deductible. And the formula used to calculate a deductible credit is similar to your pure premium equation that we looked at earlier, except this time you've got the loss elimination ratio factored in. You take losses multiplied by 1 minus your loss elimination ratio, plus your fixed expenses, and divide by 1 minus variable expenses. And in this case, variable also includes the profit and contingencies components as well. For this example, we'll show some data on deductibles and how it can be arranged to calculate a loss elimination ratio. And the way the losses are organized by row is to look at losses between given amounts. For instance, the first row has only losses that were between $0 and $100. So we had 500 claims in that threshold for a total of $300,000 of total loss, with an average loss of $60. Well, since these losses were below $100, using a deductible of $100, $200, or $500 would eliminate all of those losses. So nothing would carry through to the losses net of deductible columns on the right side. And looking at loss sizes from $101 to $200, it'll have a varying impact depending on the deductible. For a deductible of $100, there would be some losses left over, anything above that $100 deductible. For losses of for deductibles of $200 and $500, all the losses would be eliminated, and so forth. So we can combine all of those losses for each of those layers together and calculate the losses eliminated compared to the total losses to come up with LERs for each deductible option, which are given at the on the bottom row, of 0.239 for a $100 deductible, 0.407 for a $200 deductible, and 0.677 for a $500 deductible. Again, making some assumptions on expenses, we have expenses including commissions, other acquisition, general. This time ULAE is included as an expense, taxes, licenses, and fees, the profit and contingency provision, and other costs. And of all these expenses, there are a portion that are variable, again, your commissions and taxes, along with your profit and contingencies and other costs. And then the other acquisition, general expenses, and ULAE would be considered fixed expenses for this example. Those expense ratios are used in the formula given a few slides ago. You take your loss ratio of 0.614, multiply it by 1 minus your LER ratio, add fixed expenses, and then divide by 1 minus the variable expense ratio to develop a deductible credit. So to go from a policy that doesn't have a deductible to one with a $100 deductible, you would apply a factor of 0.848 to adjust the premium for that deductible, and so forth for $200 and $500 deductibles.
Okay, we're going to go a little bit into some of the advanced techniques, because the examples that Gavin gave you, both for class and for deductible, it's looking at one rating variable at a time. So we're going to look at some more advanced techniques where we consider more rating variables at the same time. We're going to look at multivariate techniques and why we should use those, or why we could use those, and the minimum bias techniques. And then we're going to look a little bit at generalized linear models, just a little bit of an overview. There's plenty of sessions at the rest of the seminar that you can go to on GLMs, but we'll just go over a brief overview. So why would we want to use a multivariate technique? Well, if we're only using a one-way analysis, we're making the assumption that the effects of a single variable or a single rating variable are independent of all other rating variables. And we don't consider at all the correlation or interaction between the rating variables. So as an example, car value and model year. Well, we know that, you know, a car with a newer model year is probably has a higher value. And if we look at them separately, we're not taking into consideration that correlation. Interaction, driving record, and age. We're pretty familiar that, you know, a 16-year-old probably has a worse driving record than maybe a 50-year-old does. And we're not taking into account that interaction if we're looking at them separately. Or type of construction and fire protection. We know that a frame house versus a brick house, you know, makes a big difference as far as fire protection goes. And if we're looking at each of those variables separately, again, we're not accounting for any of the interaction between the two. So a multivariate technique is going to remove any double counting of the same underlying effect. It will account for different percentages of each rating variable within the other rating variables, and then we'll arrive at a set of relativities for each variable that would best represent the experience as a whole, as opposed to each variable individually. We use the minimum bias techniques for multivariate analysis. The idea is to optimize the relativities for two or more rating variables. So we want to calculate relativities which are as close to the actual relativities as possible. Close being measured by some bias functions, and we're going to go over those. And the bias function determines a set of equations relating the observed data to the rating, a set of equations relating the observed data and the rating variables. So we use an iterative technique starting with observed data until we get to really the optimal solution, till it converges to the optimal solution. So in the minimum bias technique, we'll have two rating variables with relativities x sub I and y sub j. We'll start and select an initial value for each x sub I, and then we use the model to solve for the y sub j's. So then, after you've done that, you take the newly calculated y sub j, and then you go back and solve for the x sub I. So this process continues until the solutions converge. There's two techniques we're going to talk about, the least squares method and Bayley's minimum bias. They're two of the, I think, most widely used minimum bias techniques. The least squares method is going to minimize a weighted squared error between the indicated and observed relativities. So the equation's on there. It's pretty much saying what I just said in words, but the minimizes of x or sub xy, the summation across all i's and j's, taking the weights times the observed relativity minus the relativities for rating variables I and j squared. So we're really just trying to minimize that function and minimize the error between indicated and observed relativities. So the formula, if we were solving for x sub I, would be the one that's shown here, the summation of the weights times the observed relativities times the relativity for rating variable j over the summation of the weights times the relativity for rating variable j squared. The other method is the Bayley's minimum bias. And this minimizes the bias across the dimensions of the class system. So it's really trying to accomplish this balance principle, which is saying that the summation of the observed relativities should equal the summation of the indicated relativities. And the equation's there, too. The summation across the weights times the observed relativities would equal the summation of the weights times the individual relativities for I and J. And this is then the equation to solve for x sub I for Bayley's minimum bias. You're going to see the summation across the weights and the observed relativity for ij over the summation across the weights and the relativity for rating variable j. So deciding between those two to use, the minimum Bayley's minimum bias has some some perks to using it. It's less sensitive to the experience of individual cells than the least squares method is. It is widely used, like, for example, the ISO-GL loss costs reviews use it. It can be multiplicative or additive. It can be used for many different dimensions, though that makes convergence more difficult, and it is easily coded in spreadsheets. And then generalized linear models. They provide a generalized framework for fitting multivariate linear models. It's a statistical model which would start with assumption regarding the distribution of the data, and the assumptions are made that so that they're explicit and testable, and it provides a framework to allow the actuary to assess the results. They can be done in SAS or other statistical software packages. They can run many variables. And then the minimum bias models that we just talked about are specific cases of the GLM. So, for instance, the Bayley's minimum bias can be derived using the Poisson distribution and the maximum likelihood estimation. And generalized linear models also are used quite often. ISO applications, we see them in business owners, commercial property, GL homeowners, and personal auto. That concludes the part of our presentation. I must have talked fast because we were definitely worried about our time. We did include a lot of suggested readings. The first page of suggested readings is, I believe, around the first part of our presentation to the overall indication methodology. And then the second part of the readings are, or I might have that reversed. I have it reversed, but they're separated by the indication and the rate relativities. But we have plenty of time for questions, so if there's any questions, please. Please ask. No, huh? Everyone wants to go to lunch. Okay, well, thank you for coming then.
That concludes the presentation.